Hi guys, it's Annie McDonald, physio and strength and conditioning coach, and welcome to the Informed Performance podcast. On today's show, I have the pleasure of speaking to Luke Passman. Luke, just like myself, has been a British practitioner based on the East Coast of America in recent years, and he's been supporting the New York Mets Major League Baseball organization as their strength and conditioning coordinator. In this episode, Luke and myself will discuss his evolution and approach to leadership, as well as how he approaches performance modeling. So you're in for a great episode. This episode has been sponsored by Vol Performance, makers of ForceDex, the world's fastest, easiest, and most powerful dual force plate system. ForceDex can help you to analyze neuromuscular strength, performance, and imbalances in your athletes. With an incredibly simple setup and intuitive software, ForceDex automatically detects over 15 common force plate tests and analyzes them with a single click, helping you to collect quick and accurate insights on your athletes. To learn more, head over to our sponsor, VolPerformance.com. All right, Luke, it's been a long time coming. We've been ships in the night for a few years. We've been mapping this episode out for a good few years, so it's good to finally get you on the show, mate.
Yeah, we have. It's been a long time in the making. Hopefully, it's worth the wait.
I'm sure it will be. Just to kind of kick us off, as is kind of tradition, can you walk us through your background, kind of what you do, but then also like, you know, where you've been along the road?
Yeah, sure. So started off at education in the UK, bachelor's, master's, all of that stuff in the UK, and then worked for 2 years for Teesside University, where I graduated, working with their sort of TAS and national level athletes, primarily sort of middle distance runners. Did a season with the Newcastle Falcons, a season-long internship with them, and then actually got offered a job in the south of Spain at a tennis academy there, and worked sort of out 4 years with like academy tennis, and then sort of the last sort of two and a half years more traveling on the tour, you know, WTA, ATP, ITF, and also overseeing some of the like other departments and things like that in at the academy. So, you know, psychology, nutrition, physiotherapy, and so on. And then had the opportunity to come over to the States and work for the New York Mets, where I've been for the last 5 years. And sort of my role has changed a good bit over that period of time, where sort of started off where had, I think when I started, it was seven coaches. We've now got sort of 14 within the S&C department. You know, it's quite sort of a broad spectrum where there's seven different teams across two different countries, generally touching upon, I think it's around 275 athletes, you know, throughout the entire sort of baseball player development system. So, yeah, I think there's over the course of the 5 years, there's been quite a few different roles that I've had, you know, within that space. But that sort of led me to where I am now.
Sure. Something I've never asked you actually, which despite having like quite a few social conversations with you, I've never sort of thought to ask, but how did the Mets job come about? Because I feel like in the States, especially, obviously not with the Mets, but with a lot of teams and leagues want league experience. So how did the kind of Mets gig come about?
Yeah, I've been very fortunate, and this potentially isn't the answer that maybe the new people coming out of university want to hear, but it's contacts. So I was actually I know you asked me about Mets, but when I moved to Spain, that was a referral. Somebody had recommended me for the role, went through interviews and so on along with other people, and I was eventually successful, but that wasn't one that I applied for per se. It was one that somebody recommended me for and said, you know, would you be interested in this? I said, yes. And then sent through my details and went through interviews. A good friend of mine came out here to the States as the performance director here. And I was in my last year of while I was sort of working in Soto, and in Spain. And I knew that, you know, I was maybe looking for a bit of a fresh challenge. And we just spent quite a bit of time on the phone back and forth, you know, just we'd always spent our time just sort of bouncing ideas off each other and troubleshooting stuff together throughout our careers. And afterwards, when I ended up sort of deciding that I wanted something different, he asked, said, well, you know, would you be interested in this? I think we'd maybe spent the best part of 4 or 5 months sort of troubleshooting stuff. So I felt like I had a pretty good idea of the landscape there. But that didn't necessarily spare me much. I had 5 interviews in total, with the last one being with the general manager and the assistant general manager, which was certainly something I won't ever forget. That was a pretty strong memory. So, came up really through contacts and, making sure you make a good impression on the right people.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the key thing there, which probably that kind of piece that you just said, is like actually just managing the relationship and having an authentic, like bilateral relationship with someone where you kind of both bring value to each other before opportunities arise.
Exactly. I'll hold my hands up. There's many more people that are far better at networking than I am. But it really is about the sort of the quality and the depth of your relationships that you have with people that actually make a difference. You know, the people that you say hi and bye to in passing and you shoot the odd text here and there are not the ones that maybe are going to impact you or you're going to impact them massively and maybe get you sort of a job that you'd really like or, you know, create a relationship where you work with someone that's really going to make a big impact on you and you're really going to enjoy and love. It definitely is around the quality rather than the quantity of the connections that you have, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So the big rocks we'll kind of chat about today are going to be, you know, leadership and then on to performance modeling. But what I'm really curious to know is kind of over your tenure at the Mets, how your role changed and I guess like why things changed, just because I feel like that's kind of always missed, but pretty interesting to know as well for the reasoning.
Sure. So I mentioned at the start, so the performance department generally within baseball, certainly at the Mets, it's massively grown in the last 5 years. So we started off with pretty much the same number of athletes, but we had we only had 7 coaches. We've now doubled that at 14. We didn't have any nutritionists or anything like that, so that wasn't a department when I started. The SNC coaches looked after that. And really everything from physical therapy to athletic training to S&C, nutrition, psychology, it's all just massively grown. And there's pretty much a dedicated person across each individual discipline for each individual team. So the department has grown exponentially in that period of time. And really sort of with that, a lot of the asks of me, but also the scope of my role has sort of really increased within that period of time as well. It started off where there was quite a lot of delivery from my side that was being asked. So in 19, I delivered quite intensively actually to players at the complex and our Florida complex, but also to our prospects as well, like our top 20 or top 30 prospects. Some organizations use that approach, and some don't, whether they have a prospect system that they're quite overt about or not. And then in 20, obviously, it was COVID. So then I was in New York with the team, you know, delivering coaching, boots on the ground every day. In 21, I was still department lead, so overseeing all of the coaches and managing everything. But I was also the rehab S&C for the major and the minor league, so first team and player development. So a lot of, you know, hands-on day-to-day coaching there, sort of, you know, 5-6 hours of actual coaching every day, plus overseeing the department space. And then the last 2 years, we haven't had a performance director in the player development space. So then there's been more of an ask on, you know, members of staff like myself to take on much more of a leadership role, and also with the increased numbers. So, you know, I oversee everything from all the way throughout the entire player system, all the way down to the Dominican Republic. So it's around 270 or so players, now 14 coaches. And also with that now insight, oversight in terms of, you know, how is sort of nutrition developed? How is that sort of relating to the physical performance goals? How is it relating to some of the specific baseball goals where body composition could be really important, things like that. So, it's definitely grown a lot from, you know, making sure that the 7 coaches we have are ticking over and doing okay and doing a load of coaching from, which is what it was on year one.
One thing I'd love to know from a sort of vision perspective, I guess, strategically, strategic vision would be, you know, you get to this team, you settle in, and then maybe the leash gets longer for your input. How long did it take? And I guess, like, what were your kind of early visions for what you wanted to achieve with the team or change perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, stepping in, I was fairly clear, but also very well aligned with everybody there in terms of we wanted to really understand what sort of were the physical characteristics or physical determinants of elite baseball, whether that be hitting, whether it be pitching, whether it be fielding, base running, whatever it may be. But taking sort of the key actions within the game and sort of really, you know, diving into our performance tests and look at some statistical analysis to ask ourselves the question of, okay, what are the things that really genuinely make an impact to some in-game metrics that we know make an impact to wins and losses? So that was sort of the broader strategic vision. And I'd say probably over the last, particularly over 2021 and 2022, myself and, you know, the sports science coordinator, sort of my counterpart, you know, we both really sort of moved that forward as we got sort of more freedom and more bandwidth. And over the last 2 years in particular, that's sort of really, you know, taken on a much bigger life in terms of, okay, well, how can we impact things on multiple levels, nutrition? How can we integrate sports science and S&C a lot more? And how can we really try and create as many deterministic models as we can to really impact performance?
Yeah, obviously you've kind of moved into a new culture, new country, and then I guess sort of quite early on or midway through your experience, you've then had COVID. At the same time, I guess, as your kind of leadership skills are ramping up or your leadership responsibilities have, you know, perhaps periodized to where they are today. How do you kind of adapt in that situation? Or how do you, because I feel like people, when they sort of look ahead to going into leadership, they kind of base it on where they're at and maybe what the people are up front of them are doing. And you kind of think of things in perfect terms where you haven't got the COVID and you haven't got those challenges ecologically. How have you been able to like adapt with that stuff thrown into the middle of it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy. I certainly didn't do the, I wasn't 100% on, you know, perfect the entire time as no one is. But it was definitely, and in the way that sort of what was asked of me evolved, also my ability to lead appropriately also evolved as well. So, and I think that also changes as well as the team that you're leading evolve, what they need and what they require is also different. So a couple of things I would just say, just sort of as broad topics is, I think it takes, you need to have an understanding of where the team is at first and foremost. You know, one thing that I see a lot is, you know, there's a lot of poo-pooing of, you know, whether you maybe are quite directive around, you know, what some things need to be. And there's a lot of sort of discussion around it needs to be very facilitatory and very much empowering and all of this. And that is totally true, but you do also have to meet the staff where they're at. And if the staff aren't ready to actually take that on board and really run with it and really thrive off that, then you're maybe not actually doing them a favor. You might be hindering them. You might be providing more insecurity and more uncertainty when, you know, you think you're doing the right thing because that's what a lot of people talk about. So I think, you know, meeting the staff where they're at on their journey is really important, and knowing how to help them or what's the best way to do that. And then the second is also what's the culture of the country or of and the nationalities of the people that you're going to be leading. So, you know, there's a real mix in the group that I've led in terms of there's some US, you know, American citizens, you know, born and bred. And there's also some Latin, there's a Latin contingent, some of which are Puerto Rican, some which are Venezuelan, some of which are Dominican. And what they expect and the way they want to interact with their leader and the support they want from their leader is really quite different. So that's something which definitely took me some adjusting to, of understanding, okay, how do I sort of best identify where they're at? How do I best meet them where they're at? And also, how do I best nudge them more towards where I'd like them to be, which is more independent, autonomous, you know, really sort of proactive thinkers, and one where I can maybe check and challenge and support rather than, you know, directing and then supporting. It took some time as the system and as the entire sort of department, but also the staff evolved as well.
How do you balance coming in, I guess, carefully and you know, open-minded listening? How do you balance that early on in a sort of leadership role at the same time as providing value? Do you see what I mean? Because you can't, I guess, like, you can't be too passive and sit back too much. You've got to have some input, but you don't want to come in too strong. How do you, it's a hard question, I know, but how do you balance that when you're mindful of it?
Yeah, there's probably the textbook answer, then there's a real world answer. So, I mean, the textbook answer, which ideally you'd like to be thrown into a situation where you can do that, is you do want to sort of watch and observe, listen, make notes, ask probing questions, you know, make some suggestions which you know will immediately add value, and maybe sort of think twice on some things which you're not sure on just yet, based on the fact that you don't have all the contextual knowledge. And you're hoping that that's really going to be appreciated. I think the real world answer is, it very much, like, context is king. It very much depends on the environment you're going into. And unless you are the person sat right at the top of the tree, which very, very infrequently you are, almost everybody has a boss that they have to report to, even if you are a head of a department. You know, even the performance director at the top still has the GM that he has to report to. So you have to balance a couple of things. You've got to balance your ability to observe and understand and gain that contextual knowledge. You've got to balance what you're providing the staff that are maybe looking to you for some help and some guidance. But you've also got to manage what's coming up from above as well, in terms of what is the person above you asking of you, how much pressure are you under to make an impact quickly, and what's the balance between what that person is asking of you, the level of pressure you may or may not be under, and then also what your staff need of you. And those two aren't always in perfect balance. And that's where it takes a lot of skill to sort of... one thing that I heard actually that stuck with me is the ability to say no without saying no. So saying yes, but, yes, however, or yes, and, to maybe some of the people that you sit adjacent to or maybe sit above you. So you can provide some contextual information around maybe why something could be possible, but it's going to have these knock-on effects. And maybe those aren't optimal and those aren't actually favorable. And you let them decide no rather than you just saying no and then telling them why. So I think a lot of it is around sort of shielding the staff that you do oversee and that you do lead, and trying to make those game time decisions of, okay, what are some of the things that we are ready to do and we're not ready to do? Or maybe what are some of the things that I'm maybe not ready to make a call on right now, and I've got to try and buy some time here, while also here are the things we can make calls on really quickly, and we can, you know, really sort of, you know, catch some of this low-hanging fruit, and we can identify that really quickly. I think when you do see that, you've got to action that really quickly, because that's where you get people on side and maybe you buy yourself time in other areas.
Obviously, now you can kind of look retrospectively at, I guess, leadership, because you've been doing it for a while. When you're kind of first getting into it and you have staff poured into you, I'm just kind of curious, like, what resources or what was kind of helping you to develop your leadership skills, or what was kind of guiding you in, like, developing your skills and putting things in place? Because I guess it's easy now to talk about leadership sort of pragmatically, but I guess in the moment when you're new to it, it's probably a lot harder.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure I have like a clean sort of textbook answer on this, but I can maybe talk about my experience. But I mean, realistically, honestly, you do have to learn just by going through it. You do have to have an idea of maybe some of the pitfalls and some of the ways in which you sort of can quickly add value, and maybe some of the principles that you're going to try and adhere to as to how you're going to do that, how you're going to lead, and what you want your leadership style to be. But ultimately, you do have to live it, and you do have to gain that experience. One thing I will say is that I was fortunate actually to work, you know, with and for people that demonstrated good leadership to me, good and also sometimes not so great as well, you know, and you learn a lot from both, you know, if you're watching intently. I've always been personally in the last maybe 7 years of my career, I've been an advocate for doing more private and deliberate and bespoke external mentoring for myself. So not me doing it for others, but others doing it for me. So there'll be areas in which I know I'd like to develop, and I'll go and find somebody that I think is really good in that area and that I really value and I respect. And some of them I've had pre-existing relationships, some of them I haven't. And I've just approached them and I've just said, look, these are some, I've built a connection with them, built a relation with them. After a little bit of time, I've said, would you help me in this? Like, I'm happy. I want to put something formal together. I want to have like an external mentor around some of these areas. So when I actually started in the role, I had somebody specifically helping me just on the leadership part, just on leadership and self-reflection. And I had that for the first 2 years of my role at the Mets. And that definitely helped me. But above anything, it's just your actual lived experiences that make the biggest impact and working with good people.
Yeah, appreciate your transparency on that as well, because I feel like not everybody would always admit if they were going, you know, third party for some guidance on their professional development. But it's sort of, why would anybody have all the answers, you know, in the moment when they're getting used to it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, first of all, I mean, the number one rule is, you know, you've got to be open about where your shortcomings are. No one's perfect. And every time you progress in your career, you're going to have a different shortcoming and a different area of development that you need. So, you know, why not be honest about it? And then two, you know, vulnerability, particularly in a leadership position, it is really important. It helps people connect to you. But just also just going to like a, just speaking to it at its core, I'm not really sure, you know, how much you get from a conference or how much you get from a seminar and all of these things. You know, it's why podcasts have become really popular, because you get to hear it from the person's mouth, and hopefully they're open and honest around their experiences and some of the troubles they've had and how they've worked through those. So, you know, I think you get a lot more actually from dealing with somebody who's maybe got an extra 15 or 20 years experience on you and has been through a lot of that stuff. And you say, hey, you know, I'm going through this. What have you got? You know, or I'm going into this scenario and these are the things that I can foresee. These are the things that I'm not so sure about. And then they help you with it. Or maybe they actually hold the mirror up in front of your face and they say, these are the things you're not aware of yet. And you need to start becoming aware of it. So the personal connection with the people, at least that I've picked, has been really important to me, because if somebody's going to hit you between the eyes with something that maybe you haven't thought of, or you haven't had someone say to you, you need to respect that person to listen to it and actually action it.
Inform Performance is proudly partnered with Team Builder, a strength and conditioning software for performance coaches that is full of tools to help support you in your daily role. Whether it's building programs, tracking workout progress, or monitoring athlete wellness, load management, and fatigue, they've got you covered. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code INFORM to start your 30-day free trial. So you mentioned earlier kind of meeting coaches that work, you know, work with you at the organization, meeting them where they're at. And you've just kind of also mentioned how, I guess, externally people have been able to give you guidance to help you develop your leadership skills. How do you sort of, you know, essentially like help the coaches that work with you to develop? What does that process look like? And how do you kind of package it with them?
Sure. I mean, there's some stuff on paper, but you also can't gloss over just the day-to-day interactions and genuinely listening, like really listening to what they're going through, really listening to what their barriers and what their constraints are, and, you know, genuinely putting time in to think about how they might be able to work around those or how you might be able to support and help them with that. So the day-to-day conversations is really important. And that's also what really builds a relationship. But I think some of the things, more sort of principle and process-based things, which you can maybe sort of really point towards, I think it's really important for any sort of department head to have like a clear sort of department goal. Like, what are we trying to achieve as a collective, regardless of whether you've got a staff of two or a staff of 20? And then everybody being aware of that, and then the entire department being aware of, okay, what are our goals as a department for the season? Where are the areas we're genuinely trying to move the needle? So where are our areas of priority? And that way you create sort of a really clear direction, a clear, you know, path and direction of travel for the group. And then from that provides like an anchor point where you can then sit down with each individual member of staff and say, okay, right, we know where we're wanting to get to as a collective. We know what our purpose is and how it relates to the wider organizational team goal and where we sit within that. Let's now start carving out some things where you in your role can really impact that wider goal, but also really impact a couple other things. One, your space that you individually own, but also some things that you need to, and or maybe you wish to get better at specifically within your role, and also some things completely not relative to your role, but are really important to you and your career. And I think that last one's really important, because if all you're ever discussing is just how they can be better at their job and therefore better for the team or the organization they're working for, you're forgetting about the person, and then you lose a little bit of the, you know, the buy-in from the person as well. So, you know, I think ultimately it's doing that at a department level first, providing that clear direction. How are we going to be measured by it? What are our objectives? And then, okay, how does your role feed into that? What are the things that are uniquely yours that we can support you and help you get better at? And what are the things that are uniquely yours around your career that we can support you and get better at? And then setting those out at the start of the season or start of the year, whatever the sort of timeline is, and then having sort of regular checkpoints. So one in the middle and then one at the end. And, you know, also being flexible enough to have conversations in between that and sort of, you know, check and challenge, say, okay, how are you getting on with this? You know, are we behind? Do we need to maybe change some of the timelines on this? Is this something that you've already completed? Is this something you need more support on? Am I not giving you enough support in this? Or maybe am I not giving you the support in the way that you need? So, you know, these are, I just think just having that general process of going sort of department first, role and position second, then an individual irrespective of organization position third, and then just having regular touch points on it, but at least in a start, middle and end of season sort of touch, formal touch point where you can discuss and talk about it.
Yeah, and I guess, like, you know, you get to a team and there's obviously coaches there, but then I'm sure you've probably recruited coaches in your time there as well. And I guess when you find good people, they're not taking a job as a bottleneck. The job they're entering is not their last job. You know, they're gonna either want to evolve within the team to another team or progress and move somewhere else at some stage. So I guess, yeah, I appreciate you sort of talking about aligning team and departmental goals with personal development goals and personal reasoning behind it. It's a nice touch point for it.
100%, because I think ultimately, I mean, it's really important to ask the question, look, what is your end goal? You know, where do you want to get to? And that, as a leader, that gives you, you know, the button that you know that you can press. Okay, well, this is where you want to get to. You know, that's your North Star. Let's align everything to that for yourself, along with your position goals and what you want to develop. And you, that's your anchor point that you can always sort of touch upon every time you're talking to that person. And I think also just asking that question, it really sort of shows to the coach, to the member of staff, whatever it is, in terms of, you know, I care about where you get to. You know, I care about, you know, how you're developing. So even if you want to get into my job, that's fine. Like, let's make that happen. So when I do end up leaving, whenever that may be, you know, unless you're at a place for 20 years, you're in the best place to take over. It doesn't mean that you will, but let's try and help you as much as possible to do that.
Yeah. And I guess as long as, you know, you interview somebody, as long, you're probably not going to recruit the person whose career goals, if they admit them, don't align to where that job that you're recruiting them for fits in that pathway. And then equally, if somebody comes in and their goals emerge as the job that they're in makes no sense, it's a problem. You want people who kind of, you can see a clear narrative for why they're going into your organization and where they may exit. I feel like it's actually safer to have that person that maybe admits their exit strategy upon entrance, ironically.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be an exit strategy, you know, per se. You know, at the same time, no organization owns an individual, you know. You know, so an individual's career is going to span across many different places. So it's better to just also be open about that. You know, maybe they're working at baseball, they want to work in, you know, in NFL, or they want to work in, you know, collegiate sports. That's fine. But, you know, let's maximize, we get the best out of you while you're here and you get the best out of us, whether that's 2 years or it's 5 years, it doesn't really matter. You know, let's make sure we get the best out of each other. And then that also gives, that's the most best chance you have of also keeping that member of staff for a long period of time if they're really good, because they know that they're being valued. And also sometimes their goals might change because they're really happy where they're at. I've seen that and I've had that as well.
Yeah, I feel like also plenty of good practitioners, you know, yourself included, are in a role in one sport, and then the next career move can be in a completely different sport. And it's not always, the roles can make complete sense in terms of what you want technically or personally out of roles. But sometimes, like, the jump from one sport to the other can look really random on the outside. But it can be quite unpredictable. You don't always know what team sport is going to be the next job, or you don't know who you know and who's going to, you know, put you in place for another job in a different league or culture, as you've had as well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the second kind of big bucket of things we wanted to talk about today was performance modeling. And, you know, feel free to talk about the Mets or not, whatever you're comfortable with. But over your kind of time there, or over your career, how have you approached being able to kind of identify what matters in performance, especially because you've worked in different sports? So I'd imagine with that, you've probably got a clearer framework.
Yeah, I'll talk about it in a broad sense, so non-specific to the Mets or any one particular sport. But it was probably I first, you know, came across it actually more in Olympic sports, and it is more lended more towards sort of I'm not sure what the right term is, but maybe sort of your classical closed sports where, you know, let's say like cycling, where you can measure many metrics and you can sort of really create a very clear sort of deterministic model. But I mean, ultimately, the way it sort of works is you have your in-game or your performance metrics, and you identify what are the performance metrics that really make a significant impact to wins and losses, or if it's an Olympics, gold medal, silvers, bronze, you know, podiums, that kind of thing. You know, if we're talking about other sports, you know, your ability to have a high percentage success rate in X, Y, or Z. So you identify what those performance or in-game metrics are that you know or you're very confident move the needle. And then trying to then sort of go through like a rigorous process of, okay, what are our performance tests? What are the things just from our tacit coaching knowledge that we think align to those? And what are some of the things that we're not sure on? And then putting those together and essentially doing some internal research and doing some internal studies to say, okay, right, these are the things we think are going to work. These are the things we're not sure on. And these are some things that we just want to add to the pot. And then running some statistical analysis to say, to look into and dive into, to let it say to you, okay, these are the metrics, the physical determinants of the physical performance metrics that make an impact on these game or performance metrics that you know actually equate to wins and losses or podiums and so on. And really, it's a lot of that comes from sort of collaborative conversations that you have with, you know, the skills coaches, the technical coaches, or maybe even some predecessors of within the performance department that have a lot more knowledge around the sport than maybe what you do at that point in time, to try and identify what are those in-game or performance metrics that move the needle. Analytics departments are massively influential and important here, because they really have, you know, good understanding on that and can have a really statistical level of understanding on it. And then just your internal research with analytics departments, sports science departments, and then also yourself, or if you're in a performance space, you know, you're getting involved in that as well. And just trying to create a really robust sort of framework of that sort of top of that, you know, approach, identifying what those metrics are, creating sort of a 2 or 3 tier list of physical determinants that you can measure and you measure regularly, getting a big enough sample size of that, and then running some internal research to say, okay, what are our correlation values with these metrics? What are the thresholds we need to be above for these metrics? What are the top 3? What are the top 5? You know, there's different ways to go about it, and I'm sure there's people much, much smarter than myself, you know, who go about doing that. Much better than I have at various points in my career with others. But, you know, that's sort of generally the framework that you probably go about, you know, trying to create a physical or physically deterministic model to give you good insight in terms of, you know, what are the areas that you really need to focus on? You know, what are the things that are genuinely going to make a really big difference to the athlete's ability to perform and be impactful in their field of play. And then you can be much more laser focused and precise with your programming as a result.
That's what I always feel like those things are easier in kind of closed sports, you know, where you, I guess, compete rather than play in terms of like team sports. Does that change much for you in play-based sports, open-ended games? Does how you get that information change much for you?
Yeah, it is harder. It's harder to have the same level of clarity and the same level of confidence. But it's not to say that it's still not worthwhile, and it still doesn't allow you to be a lot more focused and a lot more precise with your programming. I think in general, open play sports, there's much more value in the gray area of sort of training transfer and skill acquisition. You know, and I think that's something which, you know, you look at, you know, Franz Brosch, John Pryor, all of these, you know, these people that are sort of really, you know, well regarded across that space. That's why they have such a big influence in particularly team and field and play-based sports. But that's not to say that you still can't sort of identify maybe what are some of the key actions that you know really are impactful. Maybe it's not, you can't maybe quantify it in a nice, neat metric as you can in maybe some sports such as tennis or cycling or rowing or baseball in some actions. You know, it's harder to do it comparatively to those sports, but I think you can make a pretty good go of saying, okay, these are some key actions that we know are really important, and these are some of the sub-physical components that we know really impact that. Let's go about measuring that and seeing as to what we can find.
Yeah, I agree. Because, I mean, you always have to hang your hat on something, don't you? And I mean, in team sports especially, you always get
the outlier athletes who may not be the best physically in a very sterile gym sense when you test them, but in a game or competitive sense, they're really effective. But you need to create a system, and you need to hang your hat on something and have something that maybe applies to most athletes, don't you? Rather than capturing, you know, accounting for like that one outlier or something, you've just got to have something that works most of the time in those more complex.
Yeah, no doubt. And look, I think in sort of general sort of field or tactical team-based sports, there is a lot more of, you know, the team dynamic, the actual tactical approach of the team, certain specific phases of play, you know, and some other areas in terms of the player's ability to sort of tactically anticipate what's happening and their positioning on the field as well relative to their teammates. These are all things which can't necessarily be quantified and you can't put a number on. So you probably shouldn't include those things. But there are some physical actions that you know are going to make an impact on maybe some things that might decide certain, you know, phases of play and so on. And those are the things where I think if you look hard enough, you can find one or two things.
Yeah, it's obviously like in a game-based sport, you identify what matters, I guess, first and foremost. And then, you know, perhaps in baseball or football, rugby, whatever the sport is, you kind of figure out some in-game metrics. How do you, or what's your process, even, probably a better way to phrase it, for making or ruling in performance tests that then relate to in-game metrics or things that competitively you think matter?
Yeah, this certainly isn't an exact science, but the first step is sort of identifying what are the movements or the key actions that matter. And then, you know, going back to maybe, you know, university days, the textbook, you essentially do a needs analysis from your own knowledge and experience in terms of, okay, within this key action, what are the physical qualities which are going to be determining this? Is, you know, is it maybe going to be acceleration? So first 1-2-step projection, is it going to be ability to decelerate and change direction? Is it going to be, you know, high? Is it going to be max velocity? Is it going to be jump height? So you look at the components of that key action, and then you see maybe you have a list of anywhere between maybe 2 or maybe even 6 or 7 different physical characteristics that you think are going to impact that. And then you then select your test based on, okay, well, we know that with this test and this test and this test, we catch quite a lot of these physical characteristics that we think are really important. We're going to do these and we're going to collect them. We're going to integrate them into our training so it's frequent and it's not foreign to the players. And we get good intent, good intensity. And then we're going to get a big sample size and we're going to collect for a good period of time. So we really have robust data, and then we're going to actually really look into it from a statistical analysis perspective.
It's good to hear someone who's actually able to bring academic foundations and sort of first principles of science into a modern coaching framework. Not that others don't, but I think communicate, like how we kind of communicate frameworks changes quite a lot through time. I think, you know, years ago, it was very movement and kinematic focused. Now it's more kinetic focused, but it's kind of good for you to not, it's good to hear someone not going like too far down one rabbit hole and kind of keeping it much more grounded in like how the overall process should just look based on the academic rigor that you've gone through to get there. Does that make sense?
It does, but that just might simply be because I'm not terribly smart. So
it sounds more grounded in academia practically as well, which is good.
Yeah, I think ultimately it needs to be practical. It needs to be something that can be applied to chaotic, random and pressurized environments, because that's the real world of sport. You know, it doesn't, the sterile university academic environment isn't applied in professional sports because the two environments are so different. So how do you try and take some of those first principles of academia and science and then apply them to a very chaotic environment? And ultimately, also, you know, if you're not able to take something that's complex and make it simple, then you probably don't understand it well enough. So at which point you maybe need to sort of not action anything and just, you know, try and understand that a little bit better until you can make it really quite simple.
Yeah, I feel like things don't have to be this kind of trade-off, do they, where it's academic or practical? Because like you said, you've gone through this kind of process academically and being able to get to a point where you can perform a structured needs analysis of the sport and statistically appraise the kind of questions that you have along the way to getting to understand what matters. But that to me is a mixture of academic and practical in a good way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one thing I will say on that is, you know, there's in some ways that there's no doubt about sort of the academic approach. It's certainly more robust. It's certainly more precise. You have much higher levels of confidence in terms of whether what you're actually seeing is genuinely telling you what you think. But ultimately, you don't have the opportunity to always do that, or very infrequently you get the opportunity to do that in professional based sports. So that's not to say that one is wrong and one is right. It's okay, well, ultimately, what's your end goal? Your end goal is to try and win. Your end goal is to make an impact. So if that's your guiding star, then you need to take a lot of the principles that you know are really worthwhile and say, how can I apply them to my context and to my environment? Because I want to win and we want to get better. So how can we simplify these where we may not have the same level of confidence as if we were doing it strictly the way it would be done in an academic way, but we need to take some of these principles and really apply it to that real world environment to try and give us the most amount of confidence that we possibly can have while not completely throwing it out because it doesn't apply neatly when you just copy and paste into the real world and into the professional sport environment. And the opposite also doesn't work in terms of you probably shouldn't just go along without really asking yourself some of those hard questions and not having real genuine confidence on if what you're actually training is actually making a difference.
So, you know, obviously we've got this kind of seemingly performance backwards approach where you can identify what matters, key metrics, performance tests. Just love to know how you kind of personally organize your thoughts for programming then off the back of it. Very broad, but everyone approaches like how they structure this differently.
Good question. I'd say there's probably two big principles that are continually in my mind around it. So one is very general and actually nothing related to any of the deterministic modeling, but it's more of a broad athletic development model. So whether it be via age groups or whether it be via a player development system that's not necessarily age group dependent, but where is that player at and where do they need to get to? So what's the end point for them? And how much clarity do you have on that? Maybe you're early on in the journey, you don't have loads of clarity, you don't have the deterministic models, you don't have the in-game metrics, you don't have the physical performance metrics that you really want to get clarity on. But you know that based on the sport, they need to have X, Y, and Z physical qualities. And more often than not, in all sports, they need to be robust. They need to be consistently on the field of play. So taking that as the end result, as the end point, how do you work back from that and sort of create maybe different phases of how sort of players develop through your player development system? And how do you bucket that? And then, you know, when you're taking speed development, strength development, power development on all of these things, how do you dial up or dial down the intensity, the complexity, the volume, the density? How do you dial up and how do you manipulate all those variables along that journey, along that player's maybe 2-year journey or 5-year journey, depending on what the sport and the system looks like? So where is that player based on where they sit on that spectrum? And then that's probably where you need to start with your programming. And then if you have the deterministic models built out, that provides just an extra little bit of precision around how you go about doing that. But ultimately, you look at the athlete first from a fundamental perspective of, can they execute the movements correctly? Is it safe? Is it repeatable? Is it with a high level of quality? And then you start then manipulating some of those other areas that I mentioned before as you're progressing through that athletic development journey that they're going on.
Yeah. So that kind of training history of, you know, some of the things you mentioned there kind of gets them to the point they're at currently, essentially. And then what you then maybe more academically kind of discussed in terms of like needs analysis and metrics, I guess, is then how you sort of forward planned them from that point. Is that a fair summation of it?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, ultimately, one principle that I very much believe in and use a lot is start with the end in mind, which ultimately what the sort of, you know, performance modeling is around. You're trying to identify what the endpoint is and then work backwards from it to create greater precision and clarity with your programming. But even if you don't have any of that, you know, what does the endpoint need to look like for that player? where's the player at? And then you plot the journey. So it's like, I had somebody say this to me 5 years ago, actually, when I started here, and it really stuck with me. But when you put in when you go onto Google Maps or Apple Maps and you put in the GPS, you have to have your start and your endpoint. Otherwise, it can't tell you how to get there. And it's the same with this. You've got to understand where you're trying to get to, and then you need to identify where the player is. And then you can then write out your program. And then your level, in the same way that when you go on Google Maps and it says accurate to 5 meters or accurate to 270 meters, that's maybe where your performance modeling and where your deterministic models come in terms of the level of accuracy that you have around what that endpoint is, and also where the starting point is. Because that's also going to really clarify what tests you're really going to hang your hat on and say, these are the qualities that this player needs to maybe really improve upon, or is actually really great on already. And that's that level of accuracy of that start and the endpoint on the Google Maps journey.
Yeah. You've kind of interestingly worked in very different sports in the sense that stereotypically, you know, if we just took, say, rugby, tennis, baseball as three examples, sometimes there can be a different focus stereotypically between whether gym-based training or physical prep-based work is there for capacity and kind of just raw physical output, or whether it's there more for skill. How do you kind of organize your thoughts around mapping out and training for capacity versus training for transfer or for skill?
I think, again, ultimately it comes down to where the lowest hanging fruit is for that player or for that group of players relative to what the demands are for the sport. But, you know, also taking into context, I think this is what you're getting out of your question, but also taking into context what is maybe the norm for that sport. Maybe, you know, doing a lot of capacity-based training for certain sports or physical capacity-based training. When I say capacity, I'm not meaning sort of, you know, muscular endurance capacity, more sort of like strength, power, speed, all of these kinds of things. Like maybe training those qualities in a classical gym-based setting, you know, isn't the norm. So you also do have to sort of identify that and balance that. But the way that I try and organize it in my head ultimately is around, okay, we need to, no matter what the sport is, we need to develop some of these qualities anyway. There's most sports with physical output require some of those capacity-based qualities, and some of the elite players generally tend to have them to a high level. And then maybe there's some sports where you need to do that maybe a little bit less comparatively to another. And there's some other sports we need to do a lot more of that sort of gray area training, transfer, skill acquisition training. But ultimately, there should be a little bit of that in the day or at all times, no matter where the player is on their journey, no matter how old the player is. It's just, again, dialing up or dialing back dependent on the sport and dependent on where the player is and the age of the player. But I think one thing that I've seen in quite a lot of good programs is the physical prep is dialed in, and that's one part of the day. You then have your capacity, you know, gym-based training, whether that be strength, power, speed, reactive work, you know, that's in there. You have some specific sort of training transfer, skill acquisition work, which is as close to the actual skill action as possible. And then you then have some recovery strategies and modalities, and there's different parts of the day where that's clearly associated and clearly broken up. And then there's a lot of clarity from the player and to the player and also to the coaches around why they're doing what they're doing in each one of those spaces. So it's when you take the entire day, everything has been touched, and it's been touched to a differing degree almost every day, or every day there's an opportunity to train effectively. But that's kind of how I organize it in my head.
Yeah. And I'll admit, I asked you the question in quite a polarizing way, because I mean, I feel like as well, sometimes the sort of component that needs to be worked on that maybe improves a skill on field may be physically determined. You know, it might be that changing the physical output of something changes how that skill can then be completed or carried out. So it's not either or, is it? There is, there's a relationship between the two at times as well.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's never one and not the other. It's just maybe a little bit more of one and a little bit less of the other. But that is one thing where I think if you are fortunate enough to gain some clarity around what are some of the physical determinants to the key actions or key movements in the sport, that gives you the ability to identify and bucket your players in terms of these are guys that just need, or guys or girls that need to just improve their physical qualities. And just by doing that, we're going to raise their level of performance. And these are some players that maybe sit somewhere in the middle that need a really good dose of both of skill acquisition, training, transfer, but also physical capacity measures. And then there's this other group over here where they maybe have a lot of the boxes ticked from a physical characteristic capacity perspective. We need to do loads of skill acquisition and train transfer with this group because that's the group that have a lot of those physical boxes ticked. We can keep hammering away at that, but you're kind of, it's not useless, certainly not, but it's maybe a little less useful comparatively to doing some of the more skill acquisition, train transfer work. And if you have that level of clarity, it allows you to bucket your players and treat them differently as well.
Well, mate, I really appreciate your kind of clarity and all that. And it's very apparent how structured you are and all your thoughts there. And very grateful for your time today, especially knowing that this is a hectic week and hectic day for you. So thank you for getting through my my list of questioning. But where can people find you and follow you at the moment?
Yeah, no, thank you. First of all, but yeah, generally I'm active on Instagram and LinkedIn. So Instagram for more sort of personal stuff, and then quite active on LinkedIn for professional things. So they can find me on there.
Cool. Well, this conversation has been a few years in the making, and you definitely didn't disappoint. So thank you for coming on the show, and yeah, mate, it's been good to catch up with you.
Thank you.